Life after life. The internet has been abuzz all week with a rare heavenly event, and people have gone hashtag crazy. Perigee, penumbra, lunar tetrard, September equinox, and so on. The full moon will be at its closest point in its orbit around the Earth, appearing 14% larger and 33% brighter than other full moons, making it a supermoon. The atmosphere will absorb the sun's blue tones while the red tones will bend around the Earth, making it a blood moon. And the Earth will line up with the sun and the moon will take its place directly between the two, a lunar eclipse. Journalists are calling it a super blood moon lunar eclipse. I'm calling it a triple coincidence. I walk to the park, which starts at my doorstep in the university town of Moscow, Idaho, passes a strip mall, several tech companies, and, across the path and down a damp gully, a rundown campground. I've never seen people at the campsites, but there are a few canvas tents and campers with rusted sides, littered with rotting rubber tires, broken flower pots, and decomposing robins left by feral cats. Lessons in immortality. I've never seen anyone at the park, either. This evening, as usual, I have it all to myself as I sit atop a picnic table, eyes to the west. 75 fires are burning out of control in the Bitterroot Mountains, 150 miles southeast of town. The smoke's so thick, I've posted no-filter Instagram photos that look drenched in old-fashioned sepia, attaching the caption, "Toxic Skies." Later, I'll read that this is one of the worst fire seasons on record, hotter, burning more acres, and taking dozens of lives. I've spent the last several years traveling the Bitterroots, collecting stories for an oral history project at the university, and as the smoke singes the air, I know the stories are burning too. Sweeps of orange, red, and pink soar across the crepuscular sky. Sunset swag. I gaze and squint, but I don't know exactly what to look for in the sky. Will the moon pop out from behind the leafy oak, or leap from behind the campground? The mystery of it. We see with new eyes when something unexpected moves across our horizon. And something unexpected does move. A man limps across the park in a baby blue tracksuit. That, he tells me later, is made of silk. Blue-ribbed cuffs and blue waistband. The track suit's soft folds look odd against his general scruffiness. Skin pocked and sallow, gray stubble, gray eyes, and hair like a blurry photocopy. "I'm out here to see the moon," he says. We stand in the park and chat. More accurately, he talks and I listen. He doesn't get out much, he says. Ever since his accident, he mostly stays in. But he has come to see the blood supermoon and the lunar eclipse. He would not have ventured out otherwise. No, not with this bad leg. We go silent as the moon swings over Paradise Ridge, and I'm glad for the camaraderie sparked by our mutual interest in the sky. I thought the moonrise would be swift, but it creeps slowly into view. The moon's fainter than I'd imagined. Earth's shadow has already edged onto its surface. "I won't be here to see this again," the man says. A gold chain swings from his neck. His face comes into focus. His eyes are crystals. "Of course you will," I say. "The next super blood moon lunar eclipse will occur in 2033. If he's about 50, as he looks to be, there's a decent chance he'll be alive 18 years from now." "I won't," he says. His tone isn't gruff, but he's adamant. "Don't worry, I ain't afraid of dying, 'cause I already died once." I ask what he means. He fingers his chain as he tells me how when he had his accident, his heart stopped. They worked on me for a good half hour. He talks about how his soul left without a sound. and the cicadas outside his hospital window carried on. I imagine his body poised between two worlds as doctors tried to press the beat back into his heart. When I was 17, I was assigned to help the school's top competitive debater research a speech about near-death experience. Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, had come out a few years earlier, the first sustained study of near-death by a medical doctor, a book that would go on to launch the modern obsession with near-death, and it became our Bible. Hour upon hour, I sat in a plastic chair while my partner stood back against a chalk-stained board, rehearsing her opening statement to me until I had memorized the indicators of near death. I saw a bright light. My life played before me like a movie. My dead loved ones materialized, and I was at peace. In the years after high school, the stories in Life After Life followed me. I got drawn in whenever a new book emerged, and I longed to meet the people behind the stories. Accounts from near-death date to the Middle Ages, and even further if you understand the mystical experiences from ancient Egypt, India, Greco-Roman antiquity, China, and Mesoamerica to be those of near-death. In the annals of near-death experiences, reports by medical doctors are given the most credence, possibly because the innate skepticism scientists have makes them more credible witnesses of a phenomena that can't be measured. The earliest medical account, that of 18th century military physician Pierre-Jean Dumouchot, feels weirdly modern, with its claims of bright lights and feelings of peace. Monchot related the case of a man who'd contracted a fever and went unconscious for such a long time, the blood letters pronounced him dead. The man revived. He reported, wrote Monchot, that after having lost all external sensations, he saw such a pure and extreme light that he thought he was in heaven, literally in the kingdom of the blessed. He remembered this sensation very well and affirmed that never in all his life had he had a nicer moment. Rubbing his stubbly chin, the man in blue tells me that when he died, he had no memory of life on earth. He was riding his motorcycle into a vast field, soft and multicolored, as if entering an impressionist painting. At first, I think he's talking about his accident, the one that made him limp and gave him the idea that he wouldn't be on this earth in 2033. No, he says, his accident didn't involve his motorcycle. He rode a motorcycle into the afterlife, into a shimmering light, into pure love. Unlike my high school debating partner, the man isn't trying to convince me. He speaks softly and evenly like gold stitches. He seems ghostly, but he's all too real. He smells of apples and tobacco. I've seen his white sneakers on sale at Shopko. He stands uneasily, lifting the sole of one foot and then the other, as Earth's shadow inches over the moon. I'm going home, he says, though half the moon is still unhooded. I ask if he wouldn't rather stay. If he'll never see the eclipse again, why leave? I'm cold, he says, but it was nice meeting you. And he limps in the direction of the campground. He disappears so quickly that I wonder if he's even been there in the first place, but I know he has, because now everything's heightened. The cattail-tangled gully quivers, the sky flickers, birds on the electrical wire sing off-key. For a moment, life ceases to be one ecliptic march across time. When I was 10, Nellie Kelly was stuck in a nursing home with a strange ailment called hardening of the arteries, which made her forgetful and confused. She didn't know who we, her great-grandchildren, were. She couldn't recognize her own children. She didn't know where she was. She'd lost all memory of life on Earth. Nellie was a petite woman with a sharp tongue. Because I was of similar stature and because I could also make biting comments, relatives compared me to her, which made me feel connected to her in mysterious ways. The nursing home was like a strange planet to me. Aging people sitting in wheelchairs lined hallways. Others lay in gauzy rooms, mouths gaping open. Their heads shined like fancy beads. Their skin hung like old lace from their delicate frames, and they smelled light and metallic. At first I was scared of the emptiness in their eyes, but over the years of visiting Nellie, I started to believe them to be in the process of crossing over. What I originally thought was vacancy began to look like vision. We stood by Nellie's bedside, leaning over her bird-like shoulders, hoping for a glint of recognition, but her eyes focused on something far away. Though my family wasn't churchy, I knew about resurrection. We attended a Presbyterian congregation every Christmas and Easter, where I learned about Lazarus, how he was buried for 4 days, how he came back to life and shed his death clothes, how he became one of Christ's most symbolic miracles. We can all rise again. The idea of life after death sounded possible to my childish self. But it has occurred to me since that Lazarus's may have been an involuntary resurrection. Nellie Kelly herself was not asking to stay. Each year when our visit ended, she closed her eyes. Paper thin, her lids fluttered and twitched, the way water ripples and spins when fish glide just beneath the surface. The man in blue is gone. I want to go home too, but I've committed to seeing the eclipse. I wander around the park, bereft, and that's when I notice something I've paid not one bit of attention to before. Commemorative plaques like gravestones dot the ground beside some of the park's trees. Have these messages been here all along? On this night, with this moon, I rush to take photos with my phone. One tree is dedicated to Mary Nell Braun, gracious lady. Another to an 8-month-old infant, Ryan Jason Murray, our precious child. A few yards away, another tree to Ann Veseth, the 20-year-old firefighter who died 3 years earlier, squashed by a green cedar that, weakened by fire, fell on her head in the wilderness, where I had collected my stories. And then I see a simple silver sign next to a sapling oak that reads, "Donated by friends of Phil Drucker." I met Phil Drucker only once, 10 years earlier. Sitting in the corner of a stuffy hotel ballroom, I was drenched after lecturing to a crowd of 100 about the wilderness, the one that's burning today. People milled around in fleece vests and blue jeans, bidding on silent auction items like rafting trips and pottery. My lecture was supposed to inspire them to reach deeper into their pockets. Their donations would help support trail maintenance and watershed restoration. In my lecture, I had mentioned Norman MacLean. His book, The River Runs Through It and Other Stories, is set in the rugged spires and ravines of the Bitterroots. But I'd felt cheap name-dropping MacLean, like those restaurateurs who line their walls with celebrity photos, fame by association. A man with glasses and brown-gray curls appeared after I'd spoken, tall as a totem and willow-thin. I stood to shake hands. "I've walked every path through those Bitterroots," he said, and by that he meant hundreds of miles of roadless trails. He spoke as if he had something vital to communicate. "I've been writing a piece about those mountains," he said, his voice almost a whisper. "I won't ever finish it, but I'll send it to you and maybe you can."
"I can't take your writing," I said. I remember thinking it odd that a man I'd never met before would ask me to finish a piece of his writing.
"Please, just
Receive it, he said. I looked into his eyes. They were gray, soft, and full like a thundercloud. They had a faraway look, like Nellie Kelly's. Or maybe he was just tired. Sure, send it along, I said, and jotted my address. And then he slipped past me, so close that our arms touched, and he was gone. I didn't expect to hear from him again. A few months later, a manuscript came in the mail from Phil Drucker called In the Footsteps of Norman MacLean. Phil had attached a handwritten note. The script was small and faint. It read, "The writing here is not great, but I do present lots of good details, and I hope you find this useful somehow." For reasons I still can't fully explain, I didn't read the manuscript. I suppose I felt some pressure to use it in my own writing about the Bitterroots, which at the time was so much in its infancy, I didn't know how to incorporate someone else's journeys into my own. Perhaps I also felt too inadequate, too inferior a writer to revive his work in mine. So I put it in a box in my garage. Over the years, the manuscript nagged me. It seemed important, but still, I didn't look at it. And then I heard that Phil had died. Someone, an acquaintance maybe, mentioned his name, and I put two and two together. Little by little, I learned who he was from people in the community. Besides a hiker in the Bitterroots, he was a beloved teacher at the University of Idaho. He was a Buddhist, though he'd been born and raised Jewish. He'd even traveled to the Dalpo region of the Himalayas before he died and written a book about it. Still, I didn't open the manuscript, though it had more power than ever before. I was terrified to dig in and make something of it. It was his life after life. How could I possibly resurrect such a person through a chance encounter? But Phil's plaque in the park is a cosmic nudge, enough to make me turn from the darkening moon and hightail it down the trail, unlock my garage, and sort through a box with my headlamp. Phil's manuscript is just where I remember it, wrapped in a manila folder inside his original envelope. In the warm light of my house, I read from the manuscript. The trail's still there, wide enough for a pickup, smooth and flat enough for a 57 Buick. It leads south from Hoodoo Lake at Elk Summit along the end of Cedar Ridge. Broad and easy, through the dog hair thick lodgepole pine and spruce. It follows wide and true, one branch leading toward Maple Lake Ridge, the other continuing down Cedar Ridge from the East Fork of Moose Creek. Years ago, I hiked this wide trail down the ridge, past white and slightly pink granite points blasted out for the trail. Holding the pages with a steady hand, I sense Phil reaching toward me from the other side. It's a coincidence stranger than the man in blue, stranger than the full blood moon lunar eclipse. For I know the trail from Hoodoo Lake at Elk Summit. A month earlier, when the forests were just catching fire, I walked south towards Cedar Ridge. The trail was uncommonly wide for a wilderness path, wide enough for the sun to filter in through the pines and firs onto the pink granite shoulders, wide enough for me to walk alongside my husband, a friend of ours, and my parents, wide enough for history, for life after life. By the time I finish the manuscript, the sky's dark. I am on my porch and the moon is in full shadow. Without the moon, astronomers say, the Earth would tilt wildly and could cause climate changes so extreme that life would not survive. Though the Earth and the moon will, billions of years from now, be consumed by the sun, the moon's stability in the night sky seems an antidote to death, a hope. A promise. The thing about an eclipse is that it changes what we know because it changes the way things are supposed to appear. The full moon, the new moon, the gibbous, and the crescent measure our days, create our months. They're not supposed to happen in one evening. Those who spend time looking at the sky don't often think about Earth's shadow. But the eclipse reminds us that our planet casts something extraordinary into the depths of space, caught briefly by whatever cosmic body passes by. The Man in Blue, Phils Plack, and Nellie Kelly, all near deaths, are like this. Like my walk home from the park, forest fire smoke hung in the air and frogs croaked. My headlamp flashed on a paper cup, a milk carton, and a lone red mitten in the gully. But the garbage didn't annoy me as it normally would have. The empty mitten pointed, it seemed to me, to a full world beyond.